Good evening and welcome to Noir on the Radio. I'm Greg Barth, and joining me tonight is crime noir author Todd Moore. Todd Moore is the author of Mr. Chips Must Die, If You're Not 1%, Captain Cooker, and Jesus Saves, Satan Invests. He's also had work appear in Out of the Gutter, Shotgun Honey, and The Big Adios. And he lives in Central California, and he's on the air with me tonight. So, Todd Moore, welcome to Noir on the Radio. It's great to have you on.
Hey, great to be here. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks. So, for any listeners tonight that may not be familiar with you and your work, tell us a little bit about yourself. Your experience, everything that makes you the writer that you are today.
Well, I guess. I'll give you the quick bio. Long ago, when I got out of high school, I was undecided about what I wanted to do. I know I can decide whether I wanted to be an art major or a journalism major. And what I really wanted to do is play guitar, but I really wasn't very good at that point. So I chose art and then spent 4 years learning that I really didn't want to be an artist. So then... Well, and then I actually ended up teaching guitar for a living, but then, always going back to writing with really no success for about a good 20 years, I guess, of just trying to write stuff, trying to kind of like teach myself how to do it, which is really probably the wrong way unless you're very patient. And a couple of years ago, I actually had a novel I wrote published by a Spank and Ball Press. I was Captain Cooker, and just kept going for there. Like I said, always been a fan of crime fiction and science fiction, horror, things like that. I guess all the things that I would kind of categorize under pulp. But I think what I liked writing the most is trying to be a crime fiction author, trying to be like a Richard Stark or an Elmore Leonard, guys I read. Robert Parker, big fan of guys like that, and just trying to write, not imitate them so much, but capture that same kind of thing that they do. And
very interesting. No, continue. Sorry.
No, that's best. And I guess the other thing is, as a writer, like most people, I'm obviously a big movie fan. So I think, just as much as, like I mentioned, like writers, I think just as much that movies have been a big influence. In fact, that was probably, I think, kind of like the subconscious goal is I want to write a Richard Stark novel, but I want to write it like if John Woo was directing it, from like one of his like shoot 'em up, films from the 90s, or if like a Robert Rodriguez or Quentin Tarantino or John Carpenter or something like that. So obviously I can't make movies. I wish I could. I wish I had learned those skills. But I want to kind of capture that as a writer as best I can.
Well, I have to say, I really see that in your work. I think, your writing style is, it's almost cinematic. It's like you're, as you're reading it, it feels very much like you're watching a movie. And I mean that in a great way, because that's when I write, I'm trying to describe a scene with words, right? And I leave a lot of the stuff that wouldn't come through the camera, off the page, and to hear
right.
Your influences and describe how you started. I can see that in your work, and it strikes a chord with me as well, just from a writing style. Was there a point where writing, clicked for you, that you broke through and were able to, to get something finished and published? Did you find something, learn something that made it work for you?
A big thing that helped me a lot is I was teaching guitar and had a student who was a writer, more journalist than a fiction writer, and he was older, well older than me. And he's my last, he's like a less, late lesson in the day, like the last guy to leave, like after the store had closed. And we just ended up talking a lot. And I think I kind of convinced him to read something I wrote, kind of trade it, you know, say, I'll throw you some free lessons if you read the stuff I've been trying to write and critique it. Which he really didn't want to do because I think he didn't want to hurt my feelings because I guess he probably assumed it was horrible. And it was kind of right. But I convinced him, like I said, I told him, like, say, I was an art major, which, you know, if you're taking art classes in college, a good part of the class is, you know, everybody looks at your work and tells you how horrible you are. And, you know, like I said, as a musician, I played in playing bands. I've been told I suck before, so I kind of convinced him. It's like, no, you can say horrible things to me, and I'll still be fine with you afterwards. You know, so that, yeah, in fact, that's what I want. I want you to tell me what I'm doing wrong, because obviously there's something, because, you know, I'd written, oh, I'm trying to think. Well, actually, I had written Jesus Saves, Satan Invests already at that point, or at least the first draft. And I'd written some other things, but not, and gotten no success. I guess as anybody who's tried to publish anything knows that there's a lot of failure involved. There's a lot of sending stuff out and getting rejected just because, well, just because of the nature of the business. So actually, he did read something I wrote, and he gave me a lot of good advice and just kind of a couple simple things that, you know, just kind of stuck with me and kind of gave me a direction. You know, just kind of like, oh, this is why this is boring, even though it seemed like a good idea. And from there, and then shortly after that, I got the idea. I started writing Captain Cooker, which is, like I said, the first thing I published. And then that's kind of when it clicked. That's kind of when I think, you know, I think some of the things he told me, I was able to go back and read authors I like and then see what he was talking about in their writing, if that makes any sense. Whereas it's just before, I just read it and said, yeah, I really like this, but I didn't have a good idea of how to do it. And I might not still. I may be giving myself too much credit. But that's kind of the point where things kind of clicked over, and I was able to write something that not only that I liked, that other people liked too, you know, beyond. And then, you know, same as, like, if you go back to Jesus Saves, Satan Invests, I think that final version I published was like 50,000 words. But the first draft I wrote, which was soundly rejected by the publishing world, was probably right around 100,000 words. So if you can imagine that twice as long without really adding anything to the story. I think that was the kind of the thing. It's kind of like, you know, take out the stuff you don't need and try to keep it. Try to say what you want to say in as few words as possible as opposed to a bunch, you know, going on and on. Because, I mean, I think if you go back to that novel, which I guess I will because I know you've read it, you know, there's a lot of different characters in that story. And you don't need a backstory for everybody. In fact, there's very little backstory for anybody. I think that's one of the things I did.
Yeah,
you know,
it gives it a sense of mystery, like you're...
So instead of trying to, like, explain a person's backstory and give their background, just try to give it a sense of what kind of person they are. And like I said, kind of maybe hint at something, give the person an idea, and then move on. Because ultimately, I think there's other writers who can do it and do it well, and it'll be great. But for me, I couldn't. The story would just become, you know, it'd kind of bog down. It'd lose the pace. It'd become, you know, kind of boring.
Well, I gotta say that one was anything but boring. It was one of the faster paced things I've read in a long time.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where I decided that's the kind of stuff I can write and do a decent job at. It's stuff that is fast paced. It's stuff that really, that kind of moves, try to keep the reader turning the pages and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what I look to do now with sometimes, like I said, I've had publishers get back to me when they're turning down stuff and said, this is almost it's too fast. It's like, I want to know these characters better. It's kind of like, well, maybe someday.
Yeah, interesting.
I'll write something like that.
You've released a couple of titles this year, right? There was If You're Not 1%, published by
right.
280 Steps, and then Mr. Chips Must Die from Spanking Pulp Press. How did it work out that, that you have two books out back-to-back like that?
Oh, Mr. Chips Must Die I wrote the first draft a couple years. Actually, I'll tell you what. I started the first draft of that after Captain Cooker was published. I had the idea for it. And then I worked on it. And then, same thing. It's more of a, kind of a science fiction horror thing as opposed to a crime novel. So a little bit different, even though it's not that different. It's just got, it's got werewolves and stuff in it, I guess, and time travel. But at its heart, it's still kind of a crime story. I'm still looking to kind of do the same thing. I want a fast-moving, action-heavy story. But basically the reason they came out back-to-back is because that spent, 2 years being rejected and me redoing it. Like I said, I think the first version was a little bit longer, and it was in third person, and then I changed it to first person, which worked a ton better for the story and, kind of made it flow better. And then Spanking Pulp decided, I didn't send it to them the first time around. I was kind of, because it was a science fiction story, I was kind of looking at, small indie publishers that kind of specialized in that kind of thing. Whereas I also found out people that publish stuff to science fiction want stuff to be longer than I probably want to write. Because I think I got a couple more just like, well, we like things that are at least 100,000 words. And I think that one clocks in about the same as you could write around 50. That seems to be my sweet spot for a story. So, So basically that one had been done for a while but didn't get published until recently, which is, I guess, kind of the way things work sometimes.
The two books, If You're Not 1% and Jesus Saves Satan Invest, they reminded me quite a lot of that Cinemax series Banshee. And it's not that the plots are similar or anything like that, but you kind of have the pace, you have the detailed, frenzied action sequences, the rural setting. Is that something you hear? I mean, were you kind of going for that type of thing, or just coincidence?
No, I'd say it's definitely going for that type of thing. Like I said, I like that show. It's a good show. I mean, not necessarily in specifically it, but yeah, definitely thinking going for that same type of feel that show goes. Kind of a, like I said, fast paced, kind of, like a little darker side on the characters, kind of crime fiction, kind of.
Yeah.
Definitely a little bit of that. I guess I like a good crazy action sequence. So that show definitely has.
Well, you do those very well. I mean, you can see just every step of the action. In fact, I've described a sequence of in that's in If You're Not 1%. as kind of comparable to the movie Home Alone if it had been directed by Rob Zombie.
Yeah, well, you know,
tell the listeners.
It's funny you say that, because I think the initial idea for that really was, I think I was thinking, Home Alone was, I was kind of thinking about that, like the Home Alone story, but what if you told it not for laughs? You know, what if, you know, because if you take out the cartoon aspect of Home Alone, that's a pretty brutal story at the end. I mean, that's smashing guys in the head with bricks and, you know,
yeah,
doing things like that. And obviously they play it for laughs, and it's those, you know, they're kind of fun movies. But that was kind of the initial thought that got that kind of started. It's like, what if you had that same kind of story, but let's play for laughs. And then it kind of went from there. In fact, I think the final product's probably less Home Alone like than I had initially envisioned it. I think I'd envisioned the protagonist setting a lot more traps and doing stuff like that to try to ward off his invaders. But then it's way. Of course, when I thought of that, I had no idea who was going to be. That's all I had, which is that kind of idea. But that was kind of where it started. So it's very perceptive to pick up on that, because that's what I was thinking when I first sat down and started typing that out. It's like, you know, some sort of almost Home Alone type of story, but more for keeps. More
yeah,
for
just
real.
With the gorier elements, right? Would you say that this is kind of typical of how you build a story? Is you'll have a cool scene in mind, and then, you know, kind of link it up to a couple of other scenes and just kind of build the story kind of organically that way? Or is this was this a departure for you?
No, that's really the kind of – that's the way – anything I've ever done that's any – for sure anything I've ever done is any good has been that way, where it's just kind of like almost a really simple idea, and then, you know, a simple idea, a couple ideas for scenes, and then almost work backwards from there. Well, how would I work this? You know, what kind of character would get himself in this situation? You know, how would he or she get himself out of it? And that's,
I think that's it.
So I don't make outlines of that kind of stuff, or just, go ahead.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, it's definitely true for me too. I'll have an idea, you know, of a scene, and I'll carry that around in my head, you know, sometimes for months or years, even until I have the right, you know, story to put that scene into.
Right.
In fact, that was kind of how my novel Rogue Carnage came about. Was I had two scenes I was really excited about writing, but I didn't really have a story, you know, to go with it. And it was a matter of finding how to link those scenes together and what might naturally put people in those situations. So the small town, yeah, you probably could.
I was going to say, I have one in mind that was particularly good that I just the, without giving anything away to anybody, I think the scene where Selena is captured in the back of the restaurant and the fryer. I don't know
that
if that's one
the,
of the scenes.
That would be the scene.
That would be the scene.
Yeah.
That was an excellent scene. So I definitely do that too,
yeah.
Where I've had ideas for a scene that it just kind of like stay in my head, and then hopefully at some point I find some way to use them.
I think that's part of the fun of just building the story. You know, the small town rural setting really comes through and enhances the if you're not 1%. And there, you know, there seems to be a strong movement in the crime noir genre right now, where the, you know, the stories are taking place in rural settings. What kind of draws you to that setting for your fiction?
That's interesting. I've lived in both. I've lived in some really small places and some big places. there, especially like with you, if you're not 1%, I mean, for the story to work, there had to be a certain amount of isolation, you know, for the characters. It doesn't really work in a big city. You know, you can't really, it's much harder to lay siege to a house in a big city. And that was kind of inspired, well, like, it's kind of inspired by some small towns in Colorado that I visited that have family living in. I think the thing about small towns when it comes to crime fiction is maybe it's a little bit less explored, and also I think there's something about like a small place where help's not immediately on the way. I think it maybe goes back to, some people, like when I lived in, well, the other thing, you live in a small town, you do get to meet the people and get to know like the law enforcement, whereas like, you know, if you live in San Diego, unless your neighbor's a cop, you probably won't know them. And I think if you look at the statistics, and it's much more dangerous to be a small town police officer than it is actually to be a big city police officer. Because when there's some problem, you go out, you're on your own. And I think that's the kind of thing that makes a small town a great setting for crime fiction.
There's no anonymity in those small towns. You can't hide in the crowd. There's not that sea of people. And I think you really capture that in that book, because everybody knew everybody in that book. You know, the people you think of as the villains, law enforcement knew them. That's typical of those, you know, those small towns. And you drive tension through relationships and, you know, pressure on each other. And it's, you know, it's a very different feel, I think, in the rural noir fiction.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Oh no. I want to hear you.
Oh, I just kind of like reiterate your point. It adds an element that's a little bit, I don't know about unique. I guess there's been a lot of fiction and crime fiction in small towns, but it does add like a different element. The fact that, like you said, everybody knows each other. You're out there, you know, if you're in a small town, especially if you're a small town in the mountains or as I live in the desert, you know, your world's a little smaller. So the stuff that takes place has kind of a bigger effect on everybody. And I think that was part of what I was looking in there, you know, like, and also I think, you know, it affects people different ways. I think like in that book, you know, you saw a lot of people, like I said, I didn't really go into backstory, but you saw a lot of people that were angry and mean about, you know, just angry with their lives, living somewhere where maybe the opportunities for the things they want weren't there. I am expressing it in a very extreme way. And yeah, I also had it as a good place for people like for people to hide out. I think it's where a lot of people, you know, a person that wants to get away from the world goes to a small town.
So let's shift gears a bit here and look at Mr. Chips Must Die. Tell us a little bit about that one. What's the premise of that that book?
Well, the premise of that book, and this may be why I had trouble publishing, because it's kind of a different premise. The main character is either caught up in all kind of a Terminator type situation where he's being sent back in time to save the world from this werewolf apocalypse where werewolves are overrunning us, or wolf-like creatures are overrunning us, which they believe may be caused by a super smart dog they sent back in time. Thus, the Mr. Chips Must Die. But it also may just be that he's just a crazy person who has constructed a very elaborate fantasy in order to justify murdering his wife. And hopefully, if I did it right, it works as either story. It either works as a story about a crazy person, or if you want to choose to believe what he believes, it should work about a story of a time traveling, you know, action type novel. So
wow,
a little different stuff.
Yeah.
A little different than stuff I've done before. A little more complicated, I guess, in the plot. But having said all that, a lot of the book is this person trying to survive in one reality and then trying to perhaps murder people in another. So, and like I said, I made it first person, which I think actually made it work, because then he's, you know, truly trying to do more of like the unreliable narrator. It's like I said, that I wanted it to set up so either story would work. It's not necessarily one or the other, or it could be whichever one you want.
That's interesting. So you mentioned Richard Stark, you mentioned Elmore Leonard, Robert B. Parker. Who would you say are your major inspirations, writers?
Inspirations?
That, you know, you... Yeah, would that, you know, that how have these people affected your work?
Well, when it comes to both Richard Stark and Elmore Leonard, I think among the things that drew them is the fact that they wrote stories that were kind of where your protagonists, your heroes, you know, kind of the anti-hero thing. You know, obviously the Parker novels, Parker's not a good guy. He's pretty much flat out a bad guy, but it's kind of interesting to read about that and have that be the main character. For some reason, that maybe that says something about me, but that appeals to me to root for the bad guy a little bit. And you know, to a lesser degree, Elmore Leonard, I kind of the same thing. You know, like it's very different heroes, and I think I was kind of drawn to that idea. And I think it's probably pretty obvious in the stuff I wrote. I don't know if that any of my main characters have been that good of people. You know, try to make them
right
good enough people. Well, you know, I guess it's a tricky balance, and I think that's one thing, you know, like I was telling you, like, you know, getting writing advice from a student. That's one of the things you said about what he read. About the characters, like, well, your main character is totally unlikable. I hate him, and I want him to die. So it's like, well, it's like, well, he's not supposed to be a good guy. And he's like, yeah, but, you know, you don't want people to hate him. So there's that. I mean, I think both of those, if you go back, you know, I think I talked to you earlier about, you know, kind of like, you know, realizing some things I liked about different writers. I mean, they both kind of keep it stripped down and moving too. You know, there's not a lot of time spent, you know, describing the cars they're driving or the buildings they're entering or what they did when they were kids, you know, that kind of thing. It's kind of like, here's the guy. Let me give you an idea of who he is and what he's about. And this is the story. And you kind of go from there.
Yeah, very, very straightforward style those guys had. And, you know, it's funny. I would say that Elmore Leonard for sure, but most definitely Richard Stark, you know, was an influence on me. And, you know, I struggle with the same thing. How do you take, you know, a character who is a person that you probably wouldn't want to have anything to do with in real life?
That's right.
And make them compelling enough to read about. You know, that's you know, there are a lot of tricks that you can't use to endear a character to a reader that you could use if you were writing about a nice person, right? So it's,
right.
It's tricky.
It is, and it's always, and it's hard to tell. I mean, I think that's one of the hardest things when you write something. You know, you think you have you know, good plot. You know, you have a bunch of good scenes and, you know, things like that. But if people can't, not necessarily like, but at least relate and kind of follow along with your characters, I think it's hard to make it work. But on the same thing, I don't think I tried to write a, well, even like, you know, going back to Robert Park writing the Spencer novels, like, he's a good guy. He's very heroic and kind of noble and likes to cook. But I don't think I could write that guy, at least not yet, without it sounding kind of corny and just, I don't think it, I don't know that I really want to do it that well, but I'm not even sure that I could do it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think for me, I have to be entertained by what I'm writing, and I have to feel some passion about it, or, you know, it's just, to me, it's just kind of going through the motions. If I'm not excited enough to stay up at night writing it, how can I expect anybody to be excited enough to stay up at night
reading it? Right, exactly.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to someone out there who's is thinking about being a writer?
Well, I think, it's kind of cliche, and I know it's been said before, but I think the most important thing is just to sit down and write and work on things. I mean, I don't know if there's really a better practice than doing it. I think the other thing is, and I'm guessing this is most writers have a little bit, is you got to be willing to be self-critical. I think you got to be willing not to be thin-skinned, because I think some of the best things that helped me was, like I said, having someone tell me why what I write is, you know, why this particular thing I wrote is not that good, and being able to work on it. And definitely everything I've published so far was at least rejected at least once. And it's really many more times than that, really. I think maybe if you're not 1% was rejected once before 280 steps took it. But the key thing is I think every time I think the end result has been the books have been better after being rejected, because they always go back, you know, and look at it again. Instead of getting mad and saying, oh, can't I catch a break? Which I think is easy to do, is to go back and say, well, what could I have done better? And be able to look at it and see if you can figure it out.
Yeah, that objective perspective is crucial, I think, you know, having somebody else look at it, because you don't know what works, or you're too close to it, you know. And even
right.
when
it's really hard to
when I've got something you know, about to come out in print, you know, people will ask me, well, you know, how is it? Do you like it? Is it good? And I'm like, you know, at this point, I don't even know, because I've been in it too much.
Right.
They tell me it's good, and we're going to go with it. So. So Todd, would you like to go ahead?
Well, what I was going to say is I get it's kind of a weird balance that you have to strike, I think, writing, because on the one hand, you have to believe that you have something interesting to say, or, you know, an interesting story. So you have to have enough self-confidence to believe that you have something interesting to say, that you have something that people want to read. But on the other hand, you have to have low enough, you know, you have to be able to put that aside and say, well, but maybe I don't, you know, what can I do to make that better? I guess it's, you know, to ride the line between, you know, believing in yourself, but also knowing that, hey, it may not be that great, you know, that you really have to work on it.
Yeah, it's more of a matter of how can you make it better, right? How can you,
right.
you put out the best possible product? So Todd, would you like to read a short passage of something for us tonight?
Sure. Let me... how about just something from If You're Not 1%? I'll just read the opening of
that.
I think that would
be great.
Give people an idea of what it sounds like or what I'm going for there. All right.
Excellent. Take it away.
Well, I'll just jump in. Okay, so here's chapter one of If You Are Not 1%. You said you always dreamt of killing somebody. Lenny shook his head. It's dream come true time, Damien told him. Pug, who was standing with him across the dirt road from Rem's place, nodded in agreement. Lenny shook his head again, but did not take another step toward the house. He looked at the glorified shack his friend Rem rented on the edge of a big ranch. Come on, go get it done. It's your dream. Yeah, Lenny said without moving. He's not going to do it, Pug said. Damien pulled the big hunting knife he kept in a leather sheath hanging from his belt at all times. He admired the way it shone when the lone streetlight hit the polished blade. Of course he is. Lenny's no pussy. At least I don't think he is, Damien said as he spun the knife over his wrist as if for a baton. I'm not. It's just... Who's your pal? Damien asked. Yeah. The pal that knows who we are and what we're going to do. Well, not everything or anything. He just suspects. Are you saying you can't fuck all this up for all of us? I don't know. I do. If I'd seen this coming, well, you didn't see it coming. The thing is, Lenny, no one expects you to see the future. When something gets fucked up and that something is your fault, then you have to fix it. Yeah. So what the hell are you waiting for? Lenny looked at his revolver, found it as freshly oiled and loaded as it had been the last few times he checked. Saw Pug tense up and move his hand closer to his jacket. For the first time since they arrived, it occurred to him that instead of shooting his new friend, he could pop his two old ones. Damien quit flipping his knife around, but he did not put it away. Lenny dug the spare key he'd stolen the day before out of his pocket. He'd gone to Rem's house to pick up the money Rem owed him for helping put up a new fence around one of the lake houses, snatched the key. You remember Rem telling him Damien was a fucking dumb shit. He liked Rem, who had been showing him how to fix fences and such and paint him, even though Lenny knew he was not much help. Rem never talked down to him. Even though Rem was older and, unlike Lenny, had been places other than this tired little town tucked deep in the mountains, he never acted like he was better. Problem was, all Rem was offering was some cash, basic skills, and friendship. Damien was offering much more. Damien was offering an opportunity to make every person who ever called him Lenny lose regret it. Lenny began walking briskly through the cold air to his former friend's house. And there you go, a little bit of If You're Not 1%.
Excellent, excellent. Yes, highly recommended. I enjoyed that book tremendously. So Todd, where can people find you out there on the web? Oh, you're welcome. Where can people find you out there on the web and keep up with you?
Probably Facebook and Twitter are the two best places. If you go to Twitter, I'm at ToddMorr1. It's ToddMorr1. And if you go either to my author page on Facebook, which is just Todd Morr, or even if you just go to my personal page, I guess you would call it, I usually post things up there to keep people up to date on what I'm up to in the near future. And those would probably be the best. I don't have an author website. Maybe I should, but I seem to have good luck.
No, I know what you mean.
Going without.
Well, Todd,
it.
I want to thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's been great. Let's get you back on, you know, soon when your next thing comes out. Enjoyed the conversation very much. And for the listeners, I encourage you to check out Todd Morr's books, Mr. Chips Must Die, If You're Not 1%, Jesus Saves, Satan Invests, and Captain Cooker. You can find them all very easily on Amazon. And also check out my latest, Road Carnage. It's the fourth in the Selena series. It's mean, it's nasty, and it's available from All Due Respect Books. And until next time.
I can vouch for that one. I can vouch for all the Selena books for your listeners. They are well worth your time.
Well, thank you, sir. That means so much. They were a lot of fun to write, and I hope people enjoy reading them. Todd, it's been great. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.